Hi, this is Michael Franks, Director of Photography for Nickelodeon's All That, and you're listening to the Go Creative Show.
Hey everyone, my name is Ben Consoli. I'm a director and owner of BC Media Productions, and this is the Go Creative Show, the show dedicated to creative professionals in the video production and filmmaking industries. Today we interview Michael Franks, cinematographer for the Nickelodeon's reboot of the 90s sketch comedy TV show, All That. Michael shares stories from his early career at Saturday Night Live, the grueling work schedule needed for a weekly sketch comedy show, lighting over 70 sets in 5 weeks with multiple cameras, and of course, important tips for multi-camera cinematographers. The Go Creative Show is supported by Rule Boston Camera, Hedge.video, Shutterstock, Magnanimous Rentals, and PremiumBeat.com. How many of you guys remember All That from the 90s? I certainly do. I am a gentleman of a certain age, and with that comes great respect and great knowledge, but also remembering these crazy shows from the 90s. And All That was one of those, for sure. A sketch comedy show in the vein and spirit of Saturday Night Live, but focused for, you know, kids, people watching Nickelodeon. And it's back. And the cool thing about it is that it still has the same flavor of the original show, but with the frenetic, insane pace behind the camera that makes it extremely interesting to us here at Go Creative Show. So Michael Franks is going to talk all about how he makes this show happen week after week. And there is so much to it. You guys have no idea what you are in for. The work that he puts into creating this show and the expectations that are put on him and his crew, the amount of sets he needs to light, the lack of time he has to do it, it really is extraordinary and a fantastic story for all of us in the production industry just to see how this world works and how challenging it is and how he overcomes it. There's a lot to learn, and it's all coming up in just a few minutes. But before we get there, I want to talk about Shutterstock.com. They have something new. They have something new. You know, Shutterstock is where you always have been going for stock footage and music and photos and all that stuff. And that's still there, and that's still fantastic. But they also have something called Elements. And these are cinema quality, cinema grade video effects for filmmakers. They are blockbuster quality video effects created by industry professionals. And they include things like 4K lens flares, essential transitions, captivating video kits like smoke and fire, explosion and more, all of that stuff that you want to use in your visual effects. And the cool thing is it works on all the major NLEs. So no matter what you're working in, you're able to take advantage of what Shutterstock Elements are and what they can do for your projects. Now, I am certainly not a visual effects guru. I only do it minimally, and I'm not that good at it. That's why I hire professionals to do it. But sometimes I just want to play around and have fun. So for people like me, it's perfect because, you know, they're really high quality. They're easy to use. I can toss them into a project very easily. But the great thing is for professionals, they're great as well. Because like I said, it's, you know, these effects are super high quality and they're being shot by industry professionals with the best of the best cameras. So they are of the quality you would need to do professional work, but they have the ease of use for people like me. So you guys should definitely check them out for yourself over at Shutterstock.com. All right, let's get to our interview. There's so much to dive into. You guys are going to love this one. It's a story like none other that we've heard on the show, and it all comes up right now with cinematographer Michael Franks. So I'm here with Michael Franks, director of photography and cinematographer for many, many popular TV shows and films and live events. I mean, we're going to talk about a whole bunch of stuff with Michael today because he's truly one of the most versatile guests that we've had and really excited to dive into all the different aspects of your career. So Michael, thank you so much for being on.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, Michael, I look through your IMDb, and it's kind of like I'm walking through my childhood with some of these shows. I mean, in the early 90s, you've got the Ben Stiller Show. I mean, Family Matters. You're involved in That's So Raven is another one, more in the mid-2000s. But you've done a ton of work for children's television. You've done a ton of work for live events. And I think because there's so much here, I kind of just want to start almost at the beginning of your career, which I know sort of begin more on the photography side of things in New York.
That's right. As a teenager, I really, I was drawn to photography, and I had an emotional connection with photography. And I found that although I didn't realize it as I started, but looking back, it was really an emotional outlet for me, walking around New York City with a black, shooting black and white, and then going home and processing the film and developing the prints. I found it an amazing process that I really loved being, I loved doing. And it then that continued when I got into college and started working with filmmakers. And I realized that there was something that I loved about photography, but working on a film or that type of project was better because you got to, it wasn't such a solo process. It was a collaborative process. And that really appealed to me.
So you like the collab? I mean, filmmaking certainly is collaborative, but you know, when we have directors of photography come on here and talk about kind of their photography, their love of photography, and sometimes their photography past, I think they almost like really are excited by and welcome the solidarity of it, and just kind mm-hmm. of going out with a camera, shooting whatever catches your eye, and not having so much pressure put on it. It's almost freeing in a way. Did you feel the same way?
I did, yes. And I could shoot whatever. I think that's what appealed to me, was that I could go and express myself, whatever the mood was. I mean, particularly as a teenager, you're going through all sorts of emotions and so on. And I could go and photograph things that perked my interest, or I could see something from a different vantage point. I was very much influenced by people like Stanley Kubrick, who also started as a still photographer, and other filmmakers at that time. And their visual style, and I appealed to me a great deal. And so I like to go around Manhattan and shoot not some candids, but mostly architecture and different geometric compositions and things like that.
Yeah, when you say Kubrick, I was thinking to myself, well, that doesn't sound like street photography. It sounds more so. That's it. So architecture kind of caught your eye.
Yes, and the emotion that a certain composition would give a photograph, or the solitude or the loneliness you could find just from photographing something, was really interesting to me, and how I could bring that out in black and white. And because I think black and white tends to be one of the purest forms of photography, because you're dealing with, I don't know quite how to express it, but you're dealing with sort of the purest form of compositions. And it really appealed to me. And then later, photographing faces and people and so on, I could see how I could use different types of light to affect different types of faces and emotion and so on. So that started to really open up a world for me.
Did you work professionally as a photographer?
Not really. I mean, I did do headshots for actors and things like that to make some money on the side in high school. But I wouldn't say I was, quote, a professional in that at that time. But it did really affect me and give me the foundation that I built on in terms of training my eye and connecting, I guess, emotionally with something, which is different than just shooting a snapshot. You know, you kind of you do something a little different in the process. Hmm.
When did you start kind of crossing over from photography to filmmaking?
Well, early on, I had a Super 8 camera, and I started shooting stuff, home movies and things like that. And that really appealed to me, and tried, you know, in camera effects of making people disappear and things like that were fun. And I did a kind of a stop action short about two shoes that fall in love. It was later in college that I really got more involved in filmmaking.
Did you go to film school?
I went to an undergraduate school at a state university in New York called Purchase, which was really fledgling, just beginning to start. And I actually went in as a undergraduate in liberal arts. I didn't go into the film school, but it wound up being attracted to filmmakers and wound up collaborating a lot on their projects and lighting them for them. And then I didn't finish there. I wound up then taking a year off, working in New York City on different kinds of projects, lighting dance concerts, and really got involved heavily in lighting and lighting design. And later then went back to NYU and wanted to study theatrical design because I felt that would be a good foundation, even though I knew I was going to really head into filmmaking or television, but wanted to have a foundation in the theater.
So that's interesting. So you, it sounds like you made the conscious decision that lighting was going to be your foundation, not necessarily, you know, camera techniques. Not that you weren't doing it, but
right.
It sounded like you really wanted to study the lighting side of things. And honestly, the theatrical stuff was kind of a surprise only because I don't think a lot of people think about live theater when they're thinking about a career in filmmaking.
True. I guess not. Although I was very, my dad was doing lighting also, which I should mention. He was one of the early pioneers of television. And so I did have a sort of a view into that world. And although came from a large family, we all didn't go into that business. He didn't necessarily encourage. He wanted us to find it on our own and find what sparked our interest. And it was really great to hang out and watch a lot of that happen early in my life. And I had been connected with people like Jules Fisher, who's a theatrical lighting designer who's done, you know, major projects over the years, multi Tony Award winning, and still is working in it. And Jules has also gone on to light some film, but I got to collaborate with him early in my career also after college, but that comes later.
So as a kid, was your dad bringing you on to sets and stuff?
Yeah, I did. When he would work in New York, I would come down to the studio and hang out in front of, you know, behind the camera and watch. Picked
wow,
up a
that
lot.
Must have been so fun.
Yes, it was. It was great.
How he old are we talking? How old were you when you were doing this?
I think as early as 10 to 12 in those years.
Wow. What a great opportunity, my God.
Yes, it was. It was great. And he was lighting a lot of stuff, which is not done so much anymore. He would adapt theatrical projects for the camera. And so I got to see that, how that was done. And he was one of the early people who broke a lot of those rules as far as how to light television. And a lot of that stuff has become the norm today.
Yeah, so you, when you say he was bringing theatrical performances to TV, because I sort of see it as a resurgence in the past couple of years where every year, like it was Rent this year, where they brought Rent to TV. And then I think they did, what was the other one? We covered Rent. That's why it's fresh in my mind. But yeah. Hairspray was one. Mm-hmm. And it just seems like it's kind of a new, it felt new and fresh to me, but I didn't know that that was something that happened beforehand.
Well, yes. And what he was doing was not so much the live as doing, they would take a project that was like a off-Broadway or a Broadway show and bring it onto a soundstage and light it for specifically for television.
Wow.
So that was a little different than doing those live shows, although he did do a project called The Oldest Living Graduate with Henry Fonda. And that was a live in front of an audience that we lit very theatrically because it had lighting cues and so on. But that a lot of what he brought to television was of those early days were live television, where they would do Voice of Firestone, and I'm talking like the 1950s, where there's black and white only, no recording of anything. It was live to the nation, and then it was done.
Wow.
Yeah. So anyway, so yeah, so I did have that in my, I guess in my blood. You know, there's that old joke about how do you get an elephant out of the theater, and the answer is you can't. It's in his blood, you know. Which I kind of a joke I heard as a young
yeah.
boy, and then I finally understood what it meant. But anyway, so I was interested in that and in having a career in that, and I wasn't sure how it would pan out. So I you know, there's a lot of stuff we could talk about as we, you know.
Well, yeah, no. Tell me about your relationship with NBC and Saturday Night Live, like, because that seems like when I look at your bio, that was, you know, fairly early in your career.
Yes, I was very fortunate. I really pushed hard. You know, I was persistent in calling them up. Someone recommended that it would be good to. They were looking for people, and because it was like 30 years after the 50s. So it was they were looking to, there was a an attrition that was going on at NBC. Anyway, so I kept on calling, and I wound up getting a temporary job there. And my dream was to do Saturday Night Live. It was really one of the only, Saturday Night Live was one of the only entertainment shows done in New York that I was really dying to work on. And Lorne Michaels had left NBC a couple of years before I started and went and started a show called The New Show. And Dick Ebersol was producing Saturday Night Live. And then Lorne came back. And he wanted to make a change in how the show looked, and so on. And I was dying to work on it. And through a series of fortunate circumstances, I got the opportunity to do that and started. I guess I did two seasons of that, two and a half seasons.
So early in your career, you're lighting for Saturday Night Live, when we all know what that show is. And then now, more recently in 2019, you are director of photography for All That on Nickelodeon, the reboot.
Yes.
You know, it's kind of interesting bookends to this time in your life. And I'd like to know the parallels. Like, you must have learned a lot from Saturday Night Live that you've carried with you throughout your career, and certainly now in All That, because All That, for those of you guys that don't know, it's kind of like, I mean, it's basically a Saturday Night Live cast with kids, and but it's a very similar feel.
Absolutely. It is Saturday Night Live for kids. We have a musical guest every week, and then we do sketch comedy, and every set is different. Saturday Night Live was one of the, early in my career, is one of the biggest challenges I had. We had to be fast and good. Lorne Michaels had a very high standard, as well as having some very strong likes and dislikes as far as lighting goes. And he wanted the show to have a unique look back in those days. And we would work 56 hours in just 4 days.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, so Saturday was a 21-hour day where we would come in at 6, and we weren't done until after 1 in the morning. It was just constant changing, and you had to be flexible. And you had to be good. You had to really learn and make decisions quickly. And so that, what I had said to you earlier, was that kind of training and that kind of foundation and the pressure of doing a live national show at that point in my life, after I left NBC, really I could bring that kind of skill to anything I did after that. Certainly having the luxury of time later, it seemed like a luxury of time, even though we had to be, continue to work under tight time schedules and so on. And on All That, it's very similar that way. Although we're not live to the nation, we are doing a show in 2 days, and we, looking back over the 10 weeks that we just finished, my crew and I, we lit over 72 sets in 10 weeks.
Jeez.
And yeah, and so that alone is really an accomplishment. But lighting it, not just illuminating it, but lighting each set a little differently. I really work hard at not having a formulaic approach to what we're doing, but make an effort to make the lighting specific for every sketch that we're doing, whether it's a dark, moody scene or a game show sketch. So, that kind of also runs the gamut in terms of look.
Talk to me about the workflow of All That when you're preparing for your episodes, because there are so many skits in an episode, so many different looks in an episode.
Yeah.
And one thing I noticed when kind of like looking through stills and watching some of the episodes, it's like you really are able to make every scene look like its own. I think by having some time, unlike what you had on Saturday Night Live, you're just able to kind of customize your scenes a bit. It doesn't seem like a sketch show on the same stage. You know, it seems like you're in locations and they're lit differently for each one.
Yes. Well, early in the season, Jonathan Judge was one of the directors that I got to work with, and I've worked with him on other projects. One of the sets that I really, one of my favorites that we got to do so far is a spoof of The Silent Place. We did a thing called The Quiet Place. And he lit it unlike a multi-camera where we were very specific as far as the cameras, shots, and so on. And it was very dark and moody and cinematic. So that was one that was an example of doing something that was specific for the sketch.
Sure.
And I think the humor, sometimes the humor comes out of doing something straight and not necessarily that old idea that comedy has to be lit bright and flat and so on, that a lot of the comedy on all that comes out of lighting something as if you think it's one thing, and then the joke comes in that it's not a serious thing at all.
Yeah.
So those kinds of choices are really fun to make and really great to do on the show. It's really great opportunities to do a variety of different looks.
Tell me about your workflow. How does an episode begin for you?
We start Monday morning with a production meeting, and we read a bunch of, we actually just go through the scripts that are potentially going to be produced for that week. Very similar to Saturday Night Live, although our day would start on Wednesday, so we have a little bit more time. A lot of times the sets will be somewhat set up on Monday, and we start Monday afternoon after rehearsal with starting to rough in those sets. Mm-hmm. Then a lot of times things will change. Sometimes skits that we start to light get pushed, or they say, we're not going to do that this week, we're going to do something different. And so something else gets brought in, and we have to adapt and go with that. So we wound up lighting sets Monday, Tuesday, refining it, and then finally refining it Wednesday. We start shooting Thursday. So this is kind of the broad strokes of how the week goes. Thursday is then usually a block and shoot day where we will look at it, block it, and then shoot it. And one of the challenges of working on a kids show is that you don't have a lot of time with the kids because they're minors, and so we have to work quickly and make changes very fast. So,
well, what are the restrictions?
I believe we can only work them for 8 hours. I believe or 8 or 9 hours, and they have to go to school for part of that, and there's meals involved. So the ADs cleverly schedule the cast in such a way that we can maximize the time in a 10 or 12 hour day to get everything shot and not work them past their what they call pumpkin time, where they turn into a pumpkin, so to speak. that is an expression that's used. You know, the kids are pumpkins at this hour. So, yeah.
So when they go to school, like, what does that mean? Do they leave set and go somewhere, or do they have teachers on set?
They have a teacher on set. There is a teacher that schools them, and then the rules are different. I'm not really versed in the specifics of the rules for them, but you know, they have to go to school for a certain number of hours during the day, and during the summer, it's different than it is during the school year. Their hours are I think they have to do more hours during the school year. And during the summer, there's a certain block that they have to each complete, a block of education.
Let's take a quick break and talk about Hedge. Hedge is the backup software for filmmakers that is super easy to use and that you need to have. Simple as that. It really is that simple. It's also simple to use, and that is what makes it the best. Okay, so here's the thing. Media is everything in production. That's it. You know, at the end of the day, that's what you leave with on your hard drives. That's what you use for your post-production. Without it, you have nothing. And Hedge is the software for people that want to professionally manage the backup of their media. It's that simple. You know, before I was using Hedge, I was just dragging files all over the Finder, and this is just not the right way to do it. You don't get the peace of mind knowing everything's copied correctly. You don't get the speed that you do when you use Hedge, and you certainly don't get the ease, you know? Now, of course, it's easy to just drag one file to a folder, but Hedge lets you import multiple sources, send it to multiple destinations, all at the same time. So all you have to do is kind of set up your project the way that you want. I'm going to call it a project. I don't know what it's called, but I open up Hedge. I put my sources. I put my destinations. It's all there. I press transfer and I just let it go. I don't worry about it. I know it's being done correctly. And when I have, when the transfer is done, because I have the app on my phone, Hedge Connect, it gives me a little notification. It's the best. I absolutely love it. And you will too. And you can get a 20% off discount from the full license by going to hedge.video/go creative show. We've been talking about Hedge forever now on Go Creative Show. And if you haven't tried it, now's the time. Now is the time. Get your 20% off the full license and start treating your media the way it should be treated. hedge.video/go creative show. And lastly, let's talk about Rule Boston Camera. Rule is the place to go to purchase and rent all of your production equipment. They're located right here in Boston. So all of you guys in the area, you can take advantage of what Rule has to offer. They've got an incredible inventory of just everything you could ever want. All the huge films that come into town, and there's lots of them, people, they all use Rule. They do, because they're the best. And if it's good enough for the big Hollywood features, it's certainly good enough for me. It's certainly good enough for you guys. This is where to go in our area, right? Now, so aside from the inventory, they also have the best service in town. Production is mission critical, and you want to make sure that your gear vendors are just as invested in your project as you are, and that's what you're going to experience at Rule. You're going to get expert advice and counsel in pre-production. They're going to give you technical guidance when you take the equipment out on your shoot, and they are committed to support you throughout the entire project. We're talking about peace of mind, so great inventory, excellent service. It all comes together at Rule Boston Camera, and you can experience it for yourself over at rule.com, R-U-L-E.com. So when you have your meeting on Monday, your your first meeting, is that the first time you even know what the sets are going to be and what the storylines are?
We get the scripts over the weekend. So we read what the sketches are. And a lot of times in the sketch, there's special effects or there's people being pulled through walls or something like that. We read all of that. And we lighting cues, lighting effects that the writers have in their heads that they'd like to see. And then we discuss it on Monday. Really, what did you mean by that? What does that mean? A lighting, you know, a spotlight? Do you mean this kind of thing or that kind of thing? So we discuss it. And a lot of times I come up with that because I understand what the writers are going after and they don't necessarily have all of that verbiage in the script.
Sure.
So we come up with the ideas of what we're going to do. The sets are somewhat roughed in. We see a rough ground plan on Friday. We're still shooting the show, but we see the show of that week. But then we look at what's going to potentially happen next week. And like I said, it is all in flux. So even though it's on a ground plan and they start to build the walls, those walls could very well change during the week. So we go at it knowing that it could change, but we still have to go at it as if it's actually going to happen that way.
Wow. I'm mesmerized by how little time you guys have to pull this off.
Yes.
It's just so crazy to me. I do a lot of commercials with my production company in Boston, and like that seems quick. But even that, at least there's a full week between when you get the concepts to when you actually have to start doing something.
That's
just so quick. So are you guys working, do you just have like one huge soundstage and you keep, you know, you'll shoot on one side of it when the other side's getting construction?
Actually, the whole thing will get changed out every week. So it's a soundstage that's not as big as we would like because the grid is actually low, which is another challenge that we have with this particular stage. But it was the stage that was available, and so we went with it. We also have a bleachers where there's a live audience that comes for Friday night show. So that takes up a large portion of the stage. And sets are then built around sort of in a U around the edges of the set from the fire lane. And then we have a camera aisle that runs down the center. It's really quite exciting, actually. And I'm glad to get to talk about it because I think a lot of people don't realize what you're asking of me. I mean, the process that we go through, I think it's really... it's fun and unique in this multi-camera world. Most shows, most sitcoms have the similar kind of schedule where Monday morning they'll read through the production meeting and then they'll produce the show for a Thursday, Friday shoot. But they're dealing with basic standing sets and then they might add two or three swing sets. This show has sometimes as many as 8 to 10 sets that are completely new each week. So that is that's a challenge. And I have a great crew, Gaffer and Key Grip crew with their crew who do, I should kind of say that better. Anyway, I have a great crew who really work hard and have a very high standard and a love of doing it. And I think that's really key to how we get it done because they're very accustomed to the change. They don't balk at things, although it's sometimes disappointing. We light a whole set beautifully and the grips do their work of cutting the light and shaping it. And then at the last minute, it's decided that that's not going to really be shot that week. So it gets pulled out and we start on something else. So that can be disappointing, but we all have fun. The crew and I really have a love of doing what we do. And I think that that really helps.
So when you're shooting, when you have your live audience, are you like, is it timed the way that like a Saturday Night Live would be, or do you do retakes or?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, so, we do. So it's different than it would be on a Saturday Night Live. What I guess, so for example, on a Friday night, we will produce certain sketches in front of the audience that the producers and the writers feel would play better in front of a live audience where the kids can feed off of that energy. And sometimes it's three, sometimes it's four or more sketches. And then in addition to that, we do a live musical performance like the Jonas Brothers or Ally Brooke we've had and Daddy Yankee, a variety of different current acts that come in and will perform one or two songs.
Yeah.
And then that also has to be cued and programmed lighting-wise. Usually on the day, on Friday, we do that work. So it's really wearing two different hats in a sense. So anyway, so we do certain sketches in front of the audience that are not done on Thursday. Thursday are sketches that are sometimes edited overnight and then played back for the audience to react to.
Hmm.
So I guess one of the things that I bring from Saturday Night Live to this show is to all that is the speed and the keeping the quality level high and not, and even though we have to work fast, it has to, both the crew and I keep a very, we both have a high standard. We always say, yesterday's miracle is today's standard, which happens very much. Once yes. We were able to accomplish what they were throwing at us the first week, which was the most difficult week because we were just all figuring it out. How we're going to do all these sketches in such a short time, how is this going to work, so on and so forth. Once we figured it out and we did, that was one of the hardest weeks. Then all of a sudden every other week was similarly difficult, but seemed more doable, if you know what I mean.
When you got that first schedule, were you like, oh my God, was there ever a moment where you thought to yourself, this just can't be done. This is insane.
We all did. We all looked at each other and laughed. You know, we were like, okay, let's see how this will happen and how we're going to do this. And the same thing with the producers too. Everyone was getting their sea legs that first couple of weeks. And then it later became, we all laugh about it because we like I said, it becomes, like we accomplished it and, that became then the standard of what we do. But I think a lot of people looking in from the outside would be amazed at the process.
Talk to me about the camera packages and kind of how you run your camera department. Are you actually operating or how does it go?
No, I have four camera operators. We have, on this show, actually, we have quite a few camera bodies that, although we have only four operators, there's a techno jib, which is a telescoping arm, which for those who don't know what a techno jib is,
yeah.
like a techno crane, the difference is in a techno jib is that it's operated by a single operator. A single operator will operate the fluid head, zoom, focus, the retraction and extension of the arm, and the swing of the arm is all operated by a single operator, which takes a lot of skill.
So stop for a second. So the techno crane
sure.
and techno jibs, I just figured it was a different word for the same thing. So the jib is operated by a single person, and the crane,
yes.
you need a couple of people. You're
right. You have a grip. Yeah, you have grips, and you also have a hot head operator usually, which operates the head remotely, the telescoping. So sometimes an operator will operate the head as well as but not so much the arm at the same time. So
yeah.
on a techno crane, but a techno jib is a whole different. Animal in the sense that it does the similar, you have the ability to telescope out and retract. You can do moves that are very similar to a Steadicam move, and then all of a sudden you have the ability to boom up and go wide or whatever, or move over things, which is fun on a multi-camera show. It's used sometimes in the sketches. It's absolutely extensively used for the music because we get to do fly over the kids' heads, which are in the so to speak, mosh pit.
Yeah,
in front of the stage, and we do pullouts and move in, and we intro the band with the techno jib, where the cast is standing in front of the stage, and then the arm moves up and over them to the performer. And then sometimes in the sketches, it plays a part because we can do opening moves that are very different than you would be able to do on a dolly or a ped. The other cameras are ped cameras. There's 4 ped cameras that if we're using the techno jib, one of the peds is kind of put on the bench, so to speak.
Yeah.
And then three peds and a techno. And then there's also, we also have a camera that's at the ready to be a handheld, as opposed to having to break it off of the ped and turn it into a handheld. We have a handheld camera ready to go in case that's needed for a sketch. Or definitely during the live show, we use the handheld in the audience, or we'll use it for the music.
So you've got five ready to go at mm-hmm. any given moment. And then are you basically just moving your camera packages from set to set, or do your sets move, or how does that work?
We move the camera package from set to set. It's almost like doing a company move in a sense, in a small
sure.
way. Sometimes we move from one end of the studio to the other. There's a minion of people, of camera assistants and camera utilities that help with that process, and PAs who have. There's a lot of stuff that has to move out of the camera because we have
yeah.
directors, producers and so on at Video Village, and then the writers and so on in front of another monitor set, and that all moves, migrates with this process. So it's like moving the pyramids in a sense.
So like when you've got the director, I'd like to know a little bit more about the differences between what the director's responsibility is while shooting and mm-hmm. yours. Like, are you actually making decisions on what cameras to cut to, or is that the director doing that?
Well, it's a little bit of both. Mostly the director will do prep, and in rehearsal, there's an assistant director called the camera coordinator who will help with that process in terms of making the coverage, making sure the coverage is achieved and they get all the angles and all versions and cuttable things. So they try to do a sketch from beginning to end and one pass unless there's necessary to do different passes for different effects or different things that are trying to be gotten.
Yeah.
So I'm watching on the monitor and dealing with the lighting a lot, but then also contributing where necessary to some of that process. So the director has their work cut out for them in the sense that they have to not only bring out the best performances in the actors, but also figure out their coverage and make sure that they have covered the sketch in the best way and most editable way that he or she needs for the edit.
Yeah, because I'm thinking like in comedy, especially, you don't want to have to do a million takes. I mean, what makes it funny, what makes it fresh, is not really going to happen multiple times, or even twice, really. So you need to have coverage to make sure that you got every element of that. It just seems challenging.
Yeah, it is. And sometimes stuff comes out in performance in front of the audience that Gabriella, who's one of the cast members this year, did some great stuff live that was not even done in rehearsal. Was she just brought, like, took it to 11, so to speak. With one of the sketches called Copy, Copy, Copy. And then that became something that she's done since. But yeah, they don't do a lot of takes in this particular show with the sketch comedy, although I've seen on multi-camera other sitcoms that I've done, they do sometimes do a great deal, more than you'd think, of takes for each scene. But this is done with much fewer takes, and they try to get it quickly.
Talk to me about the challenges of having that many cameras on set. I mean, a lot of the directors of photography that we have on the show are doing feature films, you know, TV shows, not multi-camera things. I mean, they're using one camera, maybe a second as a crash cam or something. Mm-hmm. But so you kind of have a unique perspective. How do you work with so many cameras? What sort of accommodations do you need to make, or how do you change the way you light?
Yes, well, that's the biggest challenge, is in lighting it in a way that is clean and sculpted. And there is, to some degree, there's always a compromise when you're shooting from opposing angles, which we are required to do in a multi-camera situation, usually, although there are exceptions to that, where we'll shoot something, although multi-camera, we'll shoot it in a single camera style. But generally speaking, there is somewhat of a compromise in doing that kind of lighting. But we make a great effort to, I do on this show, to keep it looking clean and sculpted and three-dimensional, because you were dealing with a two-dimensional plane. You know, when you're watching television or on a computer or your phone, it's two-dimensional, and you want to have it look, I want to have it look three-dimensional and have it pop. And that's one of the things we talked about initially going into this with the producers, is what kind of look are we looking for? And they very much embraced lighting it cinematically, wanting it to have an upgraded look from what was done in the 90s. And I should say that one of the greatest differences between the two with the reboot compared to the 90s show is that the technology has grown so much. We get to have so many great tools to work with that enable us to light it and shoot it in a quick style and keep the quality high.
You are listening to the PremiumBeat.com Song of the Week. It's called Our Digital World by Crescent Music. Premium Beat is where to go for all of your royalty-free music and sound effects. Over at PremiumBeat.com, you can access a collection of thousands of royalty-free tracks for as low as $49 each. And you don't just get the actual track, the single track. No, you're going to get cutdowns, you're going to get stems, you're going to get loop sets. You have all the tools you need to customize the track that you're obsessed with into your project perfectly. I mean, what else can you ask for? And it's all for $49. It's insanity. So head over there to premiumbeat.com. Check out this song and, of course, all the others. Premiumbeat.com. And lastly, Magnanimous Rentals. Ooh, let me go. I'm going to go to their site right now. Magrents.com. Well, why am I going to their site? I'll tell you. Because Magnanimous Rentals is a rental equipment house. It's based in Chicago, but they ship anywhere in the country. Ah, perfect. They ship anywhere in the country. And why am I excited? Because they have a flash discount going on. So first things first, they have an amazing inventory of equipment. That's that. And the prices are fantastic already, just their regular prices. But they have these things called flash discounts. And these are steeply discounted items that are only available for a limited time. So I check magnanimous rentals every single day. And I think you should too, magrents.com, because you never know what's going to pop up as a flash discount. And the cool thing is as long as you order it while the flash discount's going on, you can have it delivered to your place, you know, whenever. Like, you don't need to, your shoot doesn't need to happen while the flash discount's going on, just the ordering process. So it's amazing. So if you have a shoot coming up, you know you're going to be getting some cameras. Oh, look at this, an Airy Sky panel. Perfect, under flash discount. So I've got a shoot coming up in a couple weeks. I know I need lighting. I would love to have a sky panel, but usually I can't afford it. But now that it's on flash discount, I'm sure I can. So that is why I check magrents.com every day. And you guys should too. The best prices, great inventory, and these incredible flash discounts are everything that you need to start using MagRents and going to MagRents.com every single day. Magnanimous Rentals over at MagRents.com. Check it out for yourself. Tell me about the look of this new reboot. I mean, you're stepping into a franchise that has already existed. People, you know, people kind of know what the look and feel is of All That. I mean, I kind of feel like the original All That was really kind of ushering in the look of the 90s. It played, you know, a big role certainly on Nickelodeon, but it also just had such a specific, distinct style about it. How do you approach that now, rebooting this in, you know, 2019?
Well, I think the writers and the producers pay homage to the old and create new sketches for this specific cast. But they pay homage to the old by rebooting some of the older sketches, characters, and that sort of thing. What we did in terms of the look of the show was not really trying to bring that 90s look today because the sensibilities are different.
Sure.
We wanted to make it look cinematic. We're shooting on Sony F55 cameras, which are 35 millimeter sensors, large sensors. So we have a shallow depth of field. That was one of the things that I was hoping we would be able to do. I was happy that Nickelodeon wanted to shoot 4K, so that automatically allowed us to shoot with better cameras than the typically the 2/3-inch chip cameras, which these multi-camera shows used to be shot on. So that was great. And automatically it gives us a cinematic look because the backgrounds fall out of focus. It gives a much shallower depth of field. And then in order to keep that, I keep the light levels low so that it still gives the operators some depth so that they don't have to have difficulty focusing, although that sometimes is an issue. I know it's a real challenge for the operators, but it is a necessary evil in a sense in terms of trying to keep the look the way we want it in terms of having that cinematic look. Mm. So it's a challenge for them because in the multi-camera show, the operators, at least in this show, some shows have a dolly and they have a first assistant to help them with focus. On this show, the operators do their own zoom and focus as well as moving the pads. So that can be a challenge.
Now, I'm assuming that they have handle controls.
Yes.
So, I mean, not that it makes it any easier or more difficult, but it's just you have the ability to change your focus and all that right there at your hands instead of having to lean forward or grab the lens. So can you talk to me about the lens package that you guys are using?
Sure. So the cameras are set up in what's called a studio configuration where the operators have zoom and focus on the handles as well as the, you know, where you would pan and tilt the camera. It's on a ped, which is a pedestal which rolls and can crab or dolly in different directions. And the cameras then, the operators make marks themselves as to where the cameras go for each specific set. The lenses on the, there's typically, which is typical for most of these multi-camera shows, you have what's called the wing cameras, which are on the far left camera, camera left and far camera right. Those cameras have Fujinon 25-300 lenses with a wide stop. But those lenses will go to a 2.8 or a 3-5. We typically shoot the show somewhere between 4 and 5, which is still pretty wide and still gives us a very shallow depth of field, especially on those lenses. And then the middle two cameras, which one are called the B and C cameras, those generally have wider lenses, like a 20 to 120 lens, zoom lens, also with a fast stop. Sometimes one of those cameras, the C camera, will interchange with the Technojib, as I was telling you earlier, if the sketch requires the Techno for certain moves and so on. We'll do some sort of overhead or an opening shot, which the jib really does better than anything else.
Yeah.
So that's the lens package. Then I do have a video controller who helps paint and shade the cameras, and we collaborate in terms of how the look will be, and each set is specifically discussed as we go through it. Some sets are darker and lit more moody than other sketches. We do all that. And then I get to, fortunately, also get to do color correction in the end. Once it's all edited together and we see which takes are used, I do a final color correction on the final edit. And usually that's a week or two after we've completed the episode.
Are you guys shooting in like a log profile?
We're shooting in UHD close to 4K, so it's a 3.8. So we start with a Rec 709 base, and then we paint that on set so that we have something to go from when we go into color correction that's not completely raw. Because a lot of times the network will take a sketch that hasn't been color corrected and release it on YouTube.
Oh, wow.
So that's sometimes distressing, but not really that much. I think a lot of times people don't always see what I see, but I would rather have them have a color correction than have it just go out the way we shot it.
You're recording Rec 709. So you have like a baseline color correction already. That's just, that's how you're recording. So
right.
Okay. So when you go to color correction, you're just making tweaks to the Rec 709.
Yes, to some extent. We are putting sometimes a wholly different look on it after we get there, because we have, now that we've done a few weeks of it, we have, the colorist has files saved of what the base look is, and he'll apply that, which changes sometimes the color saturation and the grayscale or the mid level grayscale, so that but the nice thing about having a look on it to begin with is it's a jumping off place. It's something to start with.
I can imagine. Yeah. I've never heard of a multi-camera, sitcom variety show type thing shot in anything other than sort of Rec 709 as a base, and then you sort of move it from there. But I'm wondering, does that limit your, I'm sure your colorists think so, that it could limit their ability to kind of push things in certain ways because you have that baked in look to start?
To some degree, although because I'm doing it with essentially a colorist on set, we do have, we've given that sketch a particular look intentionally that does give us a jumping off place from. A lot of shows, actually some other sitcoms are shot in log on these cameras. I know other cinematographers who are doing that with some of their multi-camera shows where they're shot completely, and there's a lookup that they have on set, but then they go into color with a log file.
I've never heard of that for sitcoms. I guess we just haven't had anybody on talking about it, but that I just assume because things move so fast that it's easier to just start at Rec 709.
Yeah.
Like, but especially with a show like yours. I mean, you got to crank things out so quick.
Right. It would, but then, interestingly, Ben, there is a pros and cons to both. When you go into color with a log file and doing a quick show like that, it gives you a tremendous amount of choices then in terms of where you want to put the blacks and so on. So sure. You almost start from scratch in some sense. You have the ability to affect the image vastly. But with I was actually debating that process. But again, you're right, very much because of the speed that we have to work. Those decisions are made in terms of starting with a Rec 709 or starting with something already baked in, so that because the sketches, once they're edited, sometimes are released on the internet without me having a chance to make final color correction.
I want to go back to lighting just for a couple minutes, because I'm thinking, sure. Like, is your entire lighting scheme all based, like, is it all coming off the grid? Or do you ever go in for a close-up and bring in an eye light or something just on the ground? Or is everything
Absolutely.
Up in that grid?
Yes, I think, I'm glad you asked. Because of my background in doing both single camera as well as multi-camera, and my gaffer is also accustomed to doing both, where those opportunities allow us to bring in stuff on the floor, we do. There are some sketches which are very dark and moody, and we want to light it in a specific way. So we do bring in a floor light or a bounce or something off the floor, and turn off some stuff from above so that it has a better look or a different look that we're going for. We did one sketch called Bed Bath and Beyonce, which is a sketch where
sounds already great.
It's great. Gabby plays Beyonce. It's one of the characters that she does, and they wrote a funny sketch for her where she's in her own store called Bed Bath and Beyonce, and then it ends up where she walks toward camera. It's pretty much done as a one-er where she walks toward camera, and then at the end we do a light cue, and we put moving lights on her, and there's a fan from below and some smoke, and we have a ring light around the lens. And so that is that's an example of where we made the joke by lighting it in a certain way that the writers had suggested. They wanted to get that joke for Beyonce. So those are opportunities where we do light the show differently than we would a typical multicam.
What do you think is an important skill set for cinematographers to have to get into this type of work, this multi-camera, you know, sketch comedy, sitcom type of thing?
Mm-hmm.
What skills should they be honing?
I think you bring in order to get into that, into this type of project, I always say I bring, you know, 2 weeks of prep and 30 years, because you bring everything that you've ever done to bear on this sometimes. And the more experience you have with creating a variety of looks in your toolbox, where you can do a high key scene, but still keep it looking clean and three-dimensional. And then being able to do a moody or dark scene that can be shot from multiple angles. Those are some of the challenges. But also having the flexibility to make changes quickly. That's a skill that... and I think it's not unlike doing a low-budget or an independent movie, where I find that when I'm doing a single-camera show for television, a lot of the schedule is very much like a low-budget feature or an independent feature, where you're shooting something in a short period of time and you have to shoot a number of pages within a day that would be unheard of on long form features or on other shows.
Yeah, that ability to just kind of think on your feet, move quickly. And, you know, I guess from a lighting standpoint, just being able to, I guess, not having as much control as you may want and still making it work seems to be the common theme with everything we've been talking about.
Yeah, I guess so. Although we do have a great deal of control in terms of what we do lighting-wise. I think a lot of what's enabled us to do better work is the invention of some of these tools that I've gotten to use that we've brought to bear on this. And we have instruments like Astera lights, which are wireless LED tubes, which we can hide and throw in at the last minute and give somebody a highlight or a kick or something without waiting for them to run a cable and connect it and so on. That is something that I have at my fingertips. That's just one of many different tools that I've gotten to use in terms of being nimble and working quickly. But also, I think the aesthetic doesn't change. We still try to light it in what I think is the best way possible, even though we are working quickly. And I think that's the challenge that becomes fun every week. I was telling my crew, I said, you know, that we're in a small percentage of people who anyone can light a set given more time, but lighting a set well and lighting the show in the way that we do, given the little amount of time we have, I think is I give kudos to my crew.
I want to take a couple of minutes and talk about Sigmund and the Sea Monster on Amazon.
Yes.
I haven't seen the show, but I was looking through some stills in it and just a couple of like clips and previews, and it's a really cool looking show. I think people have a misconception in their mind about what a children's show or a show starring children looks like. And then you see something like Sigmund and the Sea Monster, and it really does kind of change your perception of that.
Yes, when I was asked to do that show, a lot of the stuff on my resume was multi-camera kids shows, and Amazon was concerned. They had a very high standard in terms of what they wanted their kids' single camera shows to look like. They really wanted them cinematic. They wanted it to look like a movie. And I was happy that I was got to do that. And so we did. The bar was set high in terms of what the look was going to be. And so we gave it a very cinematic look. There were certain scenes that were very dark and moody and so on. Because it wanted to look like a current show. It didn't want to look just like a typical kids show. So we got to do that in the pilot. And then when we moved to series, we continued that style. And
now, what are the things that give it that cinematic look? Like what were you avoiding to have it look different and unique?
Well, the things we were avoiding were lighting it in a flat way. When I say that, I mean not giving the face sort of a three-dimensional quality, and also not necessarily trying to keep. I tried to keep the lighting in that particular project natural. And you know, it's interesting. I listened to some other cinematographers talk about in each age we go through what's considered natural is different.
But
we tried to light it so that it looked like where they were and the quality of light, whether we're on stage or whether we're on location, that they were where they looked like they were. You know what I mean? If we're at the beach or they're in a cave, that it had the quality of light that was realistic to that and not lighting it in a phony or artificial way. We weren't always successful in my mind, but I think the majority of it did hold up in terms of that.
Well, I think what's cool about it. Yeah, I think what's cool about it is that like, you know, you would think that a show starring kids with a sea monster would be this kind of like fantasy, fantastical, wild, completely unrealistic look. And that's not the case at all. Like it really, it's almost like a Stranger Things approach where there's tons of kids in it, obviously, but it just looks like an adult TV series. Like it looks really, really good. I think you guys nailed it.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. We used as a model, we looked at E.T., The director and I, Jonathan Judge, got to collaborate with him on that. And a lot of what we talked about was looking at that film and looking at what Alan Davio had done in terms of the monster, not the monster, but the E.T., and not necessarily seeing him fully at all times, where, you know, there's certain mystery in terms of how E.T. is revealed in that movie. And there's a lot of smoke, and sometimes he's hidden by the table in the opening, and we don't always see him fully on, shot to camera until later in the film. And so that was something we attempted to do with Sigmund and the Sea Monsters.
Is there something that you do from a lighting or camera standpoint that is specifically for, like, to attract kids? Like, is there something that children are looking for in their TV shows that you have to deliver? And how do you achieve that?
I think in terms of attracting kids to a particular show, I think it's more about the content than necessarily the look, but the look does contribute and support the content. And I would say that what we try to do is make it look interesting and make it look like a feature, so that, or as close to that as we can get, because that, I think anyone's attracted to that. When something looks interesting, it'll hold their attention, and then the story has to then, of course, be strong enough to maintain their attention. But I try to do that with whatever whatever project is thrown in front of me, whether it's, you know, Girl Meets World or whatever it is to have the lighting support the story and not necessarily be in and of itself something that's, you know, people aren't watching it to see good cinematography necessarily. That's a benefit, I think. That's sort of a bonus.
Well, parents are watching it.
Yeah, that's true. And it does hold their attention if it does have a good look to it, I think. And I think the norms of what is normal is changing. I think you used to see, especially particularly in the days of 70s and 80s, and even the 90s, shows on television were lit, comedy shows and kids shows were lit a lot brighter and poppier and highly saturated in terms of color.
Yeah.
And I think with the invention of Netflix and Hulu and Amazon, whose shows really changed the way, those kids shows changed the way television shows look, I think then the networks are following along with that, and they tend to have a much more cinematic look, and they will push the envelope in terms of darkness and mood where it's required.
Well, I really appreciate you coming on the show, sharing your experiences. We don't have many people that deal with children's television, and even fewer that are doing, you know, live sketch comedy, you know, cranking out episodes every week type of a production. So it was interesting to hear how that all came together, and we appreciate you coming on and sharing your experiences. Where can people go online to learn more about you?
My website is michaelfranksdp.com or also mfranks.com.
Thanks again for sharing your experiences, and we'll have to have you back.
Thanks, Ben. I appreciate it.
There he goes, Michael Franks, director of photography for All That. It's amazing what this guy is doing on a weekly basis to get that show out. I'm in the industry, and I still look at it and I think to myself, yeah, of course that takes a lot of work. But then when you hear the story, you're like, oh my God, how do they do it? And I'm so glad that Michael came on to tell us exactly that. I want to thank Matt Russell and Connor Crosby. Why? Because Matt mixes and masters and makes the show sound so good. You can find him at gainstructure.com, and he can do the same for your projects right there at gainstructure.com. And Connor Crosby, because he produces the show. So all of the great guests we've been getting, it's because of him, a little bit of me, but mostly him. And you can find him at ignitionvisuals.com. Of course, I want to thank our sponsors, Rule Boston Camera, Hedge.video, Shutterstock, Magnanimous Rentals, and PremiumBeat.com. Without these people, the show wouldn't exist. So please support those and support us.